amidst the flaming rubble and the war-torn bodies, Blood and Black Rum Podcast brings you Red Hot 80s Action Summer Part 3, Back to Duty. Another heaping hunk of buff, beefy, brawny men sweating it out in the jungles in communist countries you know and love. We've got hits from Arnold, Jackie Chan, the Texas Ranger himself, and more. Stay tuned the whole month of August as we cover these action hits.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Blood and Black Rum Podcast. I'm Ryan from Coltsploitation.com, and I'm joined with my co-host Martin.
How's it going?
It's doing well. We're coming at you here today with a hot American action movie. One of those movies where you just can't help but love the jingoism that's on full display. Of course, most action movies from the 80s, American action movies from the 80s, had some parts of that. But I think what we've seen so far is Chuck Norris, his movies are probably the most hot-blooded American movies that we've covered for Red Hot 80s Action Month, in my opinion. We're doing another Chuck one today. If you remember, what did we do it last year? We do Missing in Action last year. Was that last year? No. I think it was last year.
Yeah.
And then
we did. Yeah, we did Missing in Action last year. We did Invasion USA the first year.
That's right. And we weren't extremely thrilled with Missing in Action. Again, it's one of those movies that suffers from ridiculous, over the top American antics and saviorism, and I think it's another one of those ones that's just like generic in the jungles. You know,
that's not Strike Commando.
It could be that one too.
No, because at least Strike Command has heart.
It's true. It's true. But you know what? For this 1986 movie that we're covering, one thing about it is that Chuck didn't lose his fine locks in this one. He's still sporting that long hair that's quite nearly a mullet, though I don't know if I would technically consider it a mullet. Would you? Do you consider it a mullet?
No, bangs are too long.
Yeah.
No, bangs are too long. It's like a set. It's like a wispy 70s hair that's been lingering around for too long.
That's true. It is
like, somebody's like you know, afterwards, like, nudge him, like, hey, you gotta clean it up front, brother. Here.
It's like Chuck Norris in the Bee Gees or something.
Staying alive.
Chuck Norris. I think Chuck did sport mullets occasionally, but yeah, for the most part, I think he was a little bit too... I mean, the bangs are always on point. So when you got bangs like that, you just really can't cut them off. You know, it's a party in the front and a party in the back. You got to have it all.
He's just all party.
That's right. So what movie are we talking about today? What do we got on here?
The 1986 canon classic.
Yep.
The Delta Force. Not Delta Force, the Delta Force.
The
article has to be there.
It does. It's a like, it pronounces like that. This is the force. Like this is the best of the best. The special agents, they are just the epitome of America's best men. You know, it's kind of like in Commando. The specialist of spec ops people. That's what the Delta Force is. And with the Delta Force 2, the next movie in the series is just called Delta Force 2, which I think is where people start to begin calling Delta Force just... It's instead of the Delta Force, they just call it Delta Force. Incorrect. Apparently, Delta Force 2, they just weren't the only Delta Force anymore. There were other Delta Forces, so it didn't make sense to have the article on there. That's my opinion. Had you seen the Delta Force?
Like once, long, long time ago, back in the days when USA used to run Chuck films all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They did used to run those quite a bit. I've never seen it myself. Like I said before, I'm not a huge Chuck Norris film buff. Haven't really seen many of his. I think the only ones I really have seen, the ones that we've done for this series. So I don't have too much in the way of knowledge about Chuck Norris movies, but I'm starting to begin to think that I won't like many of them. I'm starting to question why we continue to bother with the Chuck Norris output.
Because you have to. There's some people you just have to give the attention to.
It's true. It's true. Whether we like it or not. You know, and so, you know, I'm not saying that I dislike them in the fact that, like, they're not entertaining to watch. I do find sometimes they're entertaining. Sometimes they're slog. I think we'll talk about that on this episode a little bit. How this movie runs a truncated 2 hours and 9 minutes long. A little bit extraneous there. And the thing that I wanted to point out too is normally when we do these canon type movies, it's a Golan and Globus production, right? Because Golan and Globus, they produced fucking million movies in the 80s and 90s.
Oh, yeah.
So many.
I'm looking at his filmography, and he, like, every fucking canon film under the sun from the 80s, he was just popping
his name on.
Pumping those fuckers out. Right?
Yes. Absolutely.
Like 15 movies a year. Like,
yep. And this one, though, The Delta Force, is actually directed by Menahem Golan. And also co-written by Menahem Golan. And the reason for that, I think, is because it is a sort of a revenge porn type movie for him. As an Israeli director, with this movie covering the Israeli Palestinian conflict in full force. It seems like it's revenge porn. So with the Delta
Force, I can't believe he wrote a film in 2009 called "Oy Vey, My Son Is Gay."
that does sound like it would be, you know, very emotional, very wow. It's amazing.
Yeah, apparently it was at a lot of LGBT film festivals and got awards, so maybe it's progressive. Who knows? It's
just, maybe it is.
It's just funny. Like, oh, hey, man, my son is gay.
What a title. Oh, boy. All right, so with the Delta Force, the movie basically is loosely based on basically for some real life events, but it's, like I said, it's very loosely based on them. The main idea of it, the hijacking of a flight from Greece, that is really based on true events. There was a hijacking, I believe in 1985, of a Greek airline flying out of Greece. And so they've really taken a lot of liberties with it, but it's attempting to depict this terrorist hijacking. And then there's other events that it kind of takes from other Palestinian conflict. But I would say that this film has to be extremely loosely based on those realities, because for the most part, the Delta Force is not even based in reality. Talk about that, you know, towards the end of the film, the conclusion has a lot of kind of ridiculous bullshit going on that we'll talk about. But yeah, it's kind of based on a real event. And of course, it's truly based on, like, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict of the time. And
still going.
So yeah. Never ended.
Also, mainly the Iran hostage crisis, too. Up until 1980.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the whole opening is supposed to, you know, the failed attempt by U.S. Army to try to free the hostages from that.
Mm-hmm.
which is such a fucking weird opening, but we'll get into that too.
It is a weird opening. Yeah. Yeah. All right. But first, before we get into the movie itself, let's talk a little bit about the beer that we have on the show today. Having a nice little afternoon beer. And this one I wanted to do because I don't know if we'll ever get a chance to have this brewery on here again. So recently I went to Maine and I was able to go to Portland and I wanted to stop at Bissell Brothers Brewing because I have heard a lot of good things about them. I know that they're in a similar vein as some of the big names in brewing right now, like, you know, our own area, Fidens, Widowmaker, Treehouse, Beer Tree, stuff like that. So I wanted to stop at Bissell Brothers and I was able to get there, get a couple drinks. And I brought a few cans home as well, because we definitely don't get these here. They don't distribute out of Maine. So I thought we might as well try it for the podcast, because I don't know that we'll ever get Bissell Brothers here. And unless we're going out to Maine at some point, it's probably unlikely. Yeah,
You might miss your vacation every fortnight.
Yeah. Well, I might again, but maybe not for a while. So I thought it would be good to have one. So... I got two different beers that I brought home. Well, three, but I haven't had the other one yet. But the two in cans that I brought home were their Exponent Pink, which is like a single hop beer. And that one was brewed with the pink hop, which I don't really know. It's sort of like new hop varietal sort of thing. And then the other one that we have on the show is called Nothing Gold. And this Nothing Gold is kind of their boxed in or double in IPA. And so... I guess I'll let you start off. What do you think about this Nothing Gold? You've never had Bissell Brothers before. How do you feel?
It's okay. Tastes like a double NIPA. Nothing really stands out, to be honest with you. Sorry, but nothing really stands out. I mean, let me take a sip. Hold on. It's good. I'd say bog standard. I mean, I don't know how the rest of their stuff is, but it's, you know, juicy, a little dank, you know, very, you know, for a double. This is where kind of like the kind of class comes in when it's, you know, if it's well made, it's very easy to drink, you know, not alcoholy at all. I'm not so certain. I didn't really read the can, so I don't want to be spoiled. See, like, what the hops in it are.
It has Equinox, Citra, Sultana, and Amarillo.
Yeah, see, the Citra is like the only one I know. And Amarillo, the other two, are those like New Zealand hops?
I've had Equinox before. I don't think I've ever had Sultana. I've never had that in anything. But I think, you know, it's like, I think they're all kind of coming together to make, like, what you said, like a really bog standard. Double NIPA. I think it's their second one. Their second DIPA that they've ever made. So again, it's kind of like one of those ones that they were experimenting and probably not really modifying the recipe too much for a double IPA. So I think for what they've offered up, I think it's really solid. Again, like you said, it's probably not going to wow anybody in terms of like, hey, that's different. That's not something I've had before. I think for...
I think at this point, especially with like NIPAs and like double NIPAs in general, it's kind of like you kind of have to do either it really good or you have to do kind of something a little, you know,
unique,
a little bit
different,
more, you know, to stand out. Not saying like they're bad beers, but I mean, just overall, like, you know, with like all the fight-ins we've had, like, yeah, they're all good, but it, you know, after like, you know, number seven of like, you know, a hop varietal of like the same kind of recipe, it does become like, okay, it's good, but you know, I really like it, but at this point you can't really go, you're not going to be like, I gotta tell everybody about it.
You've got hazy fatigue, palate fatigue.
Just in time for Oktoberfest.
That's right. Yeah, it's a good time to take a break from them. It's true. Yeah, so with Bissell Brothers, I think that, you know, what I had there was pretty solid. I had a couple different ones there, an IPA and a pale ale that they had, and I was fairly impressed with them. And so I do think that with this one, probably this is, again, this is like not one of their experimental things. This is just something that they have all the time. So for a really box center double IPA, I think it's pretty good. But if you're looking for something that's really going to wow you, I don't, you know, this is probably not it. It's just a really good double IPA that, you know, you can enjoy. You said you had that Exponent Pink as well, right, yesterday?
Yeah.
What did you think about that one?
Oh, I don't remember.
You don't even remember?
No, I mean, because I had it like at 10 o'clock at night as I was watching BoJack Horseman, so
got
more in tune with the show than the beer. I was just drinking it for to enjoy, not to critique.
Gotcha. All right, let's talk about
the last episode of BoJack I watched was great. It was 25 minutes of him giving a eulogy to his mother. It was just him and coffin shots. It's great.
Beautiful.
It was a great episode. But you know what's even better than this beer? Sound of a crisp crack of an all-American beer.
That's right.
Budweiser.
This movie makes pretty good use of Budweiser beer. I think it is pretty much peppered throughout the movie in various elements.
Everywhere. And help put up the money for this film.
That's right. And then at the end of the movie, as all the hijacked, the kidnapped people have been rescued, they're all sitting on a plane and they're passing out Budweisers to everybody. They said, drink up, it's Budweiser. There's more in the back for everyone. There's more than enough here. And then just, you can quietly hear it in the background, some guy say, hey, American beer.
You know what's best about that too? Because all I was thinking of, after the whole ordeal, they're sitting in the fucking like fuselage of this plane and wherever in Beirut in the goddamn 110 degree heat, and they're probably dehydrated the shit, and they're like, hey, here's a Budweiser. Made me think of the Yankee game we went
to. I know, yeah, I knew you were going there.
It was 110 degrees, and we were sitting in dead center field for 4 hours, and after having like mild heat stroke, getting back to the bus, as they're handing us our 6-inch cold cut of Subway, and they're like, we got beers for you guys too. Do you want Bush, Bud Light, Budweiser? It's like, I don't want any of that.
I'll take a nice crisp water.
I'll take an IV bag.
Yeah, that's probably what those people were thinking on the plane.
They were probably dead afterwards. They got, as soon as they hit Israel, they died because they're like, no, see, you needed an IV bag.
Not enough fluids. Didn't push the fluids. And you know what though? I feel okay for them though, because that means that no one was pissing all over the place. No one was probably peeing at all. Like, no one's used the bathroom for 24 hours. They didn't need to. All right, so the Delta Force.
This film, it's one big fucking long TV movie.
Yeah.
This film feels exactly like a film that either should have been a miniseries or a TV film. Because it is interminable.
Well, the movie itself kind of gets off to a rocky start because you have, as we talked about before, you have in 1980, Chuck Norris and his Delta Force team, they're sent in to rescue hostages, and it goes badly. And they come away from that being really disheartened with the American government for sending them into failed missions, basically, like that there was nothing they could do. It was already a failure. And the decisions made by the government and the powers that be that decided that they were going to do this mission were bad. And so Chuck Norris immediately says, hey, I'm retiring. I'm out. I'm not taking any orders anymore for this shit. And so then it jumps 5 years and we're in 1985 again. And it's a really, really odd opening sequence because the film never really comes back to it at all. I understand what it was going for in the sense that they were saying, listen, the people that call the shots aren't always the ones that know best, and sometimes you have to take action into your own hands. And that's pretty much Chuck on the nose in this movie, who fucking literally pulls up on a motorcycle as a cavalcade of terrorists in cars are coming towards him and does it on his own. I understand that that opening is trying to say that, like, sometimes you have to go against the orders. But at the same time, the film really never calls back to that hostage situation. What did you think about that?
I mean, it's fine. I mean, I'm fine with them setting up with the whole, you know, failed attempt to try to free, you know, the people during the Iranian hostage crisis, because I guess the Delta Force was actually involved in that. I'm fine with that because it sets it up, and like also to this, you know, what they're doing here in 1985 is a hostage rescue mission, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Problem I had with the opening is it's like 20 minutes long. The plane just, I mean, the helicopter we see from the get-go blows up for nothing. I didn't see what took it out, you know, just all of a sudden there. And then we're all running away like, oh, no, we got Lee Marvin's like, God damn, we all got to get out of here. And what the hell are you doing, Chuck? And like, he's like, is there somebody still in there? And Lee Marvin's like, who gives a shit? We need to get out of here.
That's pretty true. Yeah. Because
they're the Army. They're the Army. They're not the Marines. You know, Marines don't leave anyone behind. The Army says, fuck it. Get out. Boot, scoot, and boogie. But everyone's, you know, like telling Chuck, no, it's too, we tried to save him, but it's too hot in there. And then takes him like 15 minutes to get into that goddamn chopper and lift the Jeep up. The guy who's pinned down. And then he's running out and the chopper explodes and they get on the C-130 and they're leaving because it's a failure. And all Colonel Marvin, you know, Lee Marvin and Chuck do is like, these assholes don't know what they're doing. But wait, they listened to us. Things would have been different. And Lee's like, that's just the way it is. And Chuck's like, that's why I resign.
Yeah. It's that opening really does it. That's the part that really, to me, feels like a TV movie because it is so overdramatic, really played out. Like the whole scene where Chuck's lifting up the fucking, all the debris that's fallen on the guy on his leg. It's really, really cheesy. But, you know, it's also hilarious. And it does lead us into probably the best part of this movie, which is the fabulous soundtrack by Alan Silvestri, who apparently only composed one theme for this movie, and they were going to get their money's worth by using it literally every single time that a song is required. And even when the song is not required, because this movie, it has an omnipresent soundtrack. It's almost like, if you don't hear something in the background, then you're questioning, where's the soundtrack? Because it's constantly playing. And a lot of the time, it is such an inappropriate soundtrack for the movie. Because there's a lot of moments where, like, Delta Force is under fire and they're trying to, like, infiltrate and guys are getting shot. You know, Peterson gets shot. And the soundtrack is so fucking triumphant all the time. It has such a like uplifting sound, and yet Delta Force is getting their shit pushed in while this triumphant song is playing. It's very inappropriate, and I think it's hilarious. And that's probably my favorite part of the movie, is just the omnipresent soundtrack, which apparently got repurposed for the ABC Indy 500 theme song from the 90s, which I think makes more sense for, you know, that soundtrack than it does for this movie. It's hilarious.
No, it's beautiful. Just
and not only that, but like with the soundtrack too, like I said, if it's not the triumphant score in the background, all you hear is just like marching drum snare. Like constantly throughout this movie, the whole movie, that's all you hear. It's fantastic. It's as good as it sounds. I'll say that. So, like, for the first hour of this movie, a lot of it is dedicated to this Athens flight from Greece, where a bunch of people are getting on a flight. You know, it's a big Boeing jet, and it gets hijacked by Palestinians, although the film never actually identifies them as Palestinians. It just is very non-specific, and yet you can draw your own conclusions based on what they're saying, where you're going, you know, where they're going in the world, and their conflict with Israelis, because they specifically point out that there are Jews on the flight, and that some of them, you know, have been to Israel and things like that. So they check their passports, find out who's from Israel, and that's how you know it's other Palestinians. So they hijack this plane with all these people on it, and like I said, for the first hour or so, the movie is dedicated to how they hijack the plane. So, you know, you have Abdul, who's played by Robert Forster, and his associate, who are on the plane. They take it over, and it shows how they, like, herd everybody into one area and start to basically take over from the captain and tell them where to go. What did you think about the hijacking part of this movie?
They literally ripped off the Godfather of just hiding the gun in the fucking bathroom. But this time they stuffed it behind some toilet paper and threw a grenade in there too.
Yeah, there's like, yeah, the guy goes in and he just moves like a bunch of like tissues. Napkins, tissues just, and napkins. He's like, I'm gonna stuff this.
Nobody knows this grenade in here. And this little submachine gun, you know. It's so stupid. It's funny to think of now because it's like, oh, who are you back there? Are we good for takeoff? Yeah, sure.
Just fixing a water leak back here. No problems at all. You've never seen me before around here, but yeah. Yeah, it is funny to think of, like, the ease in which they're able to go through with this process, because I don't think it would happen that way anymore.
I think the Saudis that took part on 9/11 were sitting back there and taking notes, like,
oh. I mean, honestly, I found the...
And I say it also, too, I think, from this film, excuse me, is how we got to the modern day. No matter what, you don't give up the cockpit.
That's right.
If everyone has to die, so be it. But you never give up the cockpit. Here, your poor Ingrid's just like, housekeeping, we'd like to speak to you, captains.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the hijacking is actually probably one of the better parts of Delta Force. Again, Chuck and team are nowhere to be found for about like an hour, 60 minutes or so. They're assembling, obviously, but they're not really doing anything of note. So a lot of that opening half is about them hijacking the plane, what they're doing with it, setting up this idea that they're going to Beirut and providing reasons why Chuck's team can't just like fucking mow them down, right? Because we know that they have various hostages and they've dropped them off in different places. So they can't just go in and just take out the terrorists on the plane, because if anybody radios back to Beirut and says, hey, kill those hostages, we're being attacked, they have a problem because the hostages are going to die. So it's trying to set up this idea that, like, this is why Chuck Norris can't just storm in and take them all out right away. And also it has to set up a little tearjerker that we've got Marines on board.
Navy.
Navy. They think they're Marines. And so they're basically the American heroes that are on, that have been taken hostage. And that's what really sets Chuck in motion, is when they kill one of those Navy hostages. That's you know, that's just a line you don't cross. So I like the opening part of it. I felt like that was the more engaging part, the more suspenseful part of, like, what are they going to do? You know, who are they going to kill? I enjoyed that. I feel like the Delta Force actually kind of steps down a peg when it actually brings in Chuck Norris and his team, because
he's not around for literally the first hour.
Yeah.
But the whole setup of like them like dicking around on the plane for an hour is what makes this feel like a TV film.
Sure.
Because it's just so meandering, like it's taking its sweet ass time, like, and everything kind of happens in a way where it's like, oh, you know, nothing major is really happening, but we got things that are happening. Like, you know, as you know, they're ordering the hostages around, the little girl be like, my doll, and they're like, oh, is that your doll?
Uh-huh.
I had a daughter just like you. Do you know?
Yes.
Very good.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, it's like this is like a bunch of like Falderalds, like build these people up that like you're supposed to care about, like, you know, that's why we get the 3 minutes of like, you know, those couple of Jewish couples and, you know, be at the store being like, oh, it's my silver anniversary. Oh, oh, you're Jewish. What do I look like, Chinese? Yes, I'm Jewish.
Yeah, yeah. Oh man, yeah, that is the scene for sure when they're like, oh, you recognize this one random phrase from Song of Songs? Some shit like that Shelley Winters gets out of her ass. Like, oh, yes, that's Hebrew for blah, 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 blah. Like, and then she, yeah, like, literally, she's like, you're Jewish? And Shelley Winters is like,
of course I am. Like,
who has conversations like this on, like, a normal daily basis? Yeah, it's the film really setting it, trying to set those, you know, those Jewish people up for a bad time on the plane.
I feel so bad, too, because, like, the one guy, when they zoom in and you see the fucking tell me which ones are Jews, and Ingrid's picking up the passports, and she's supposed to thumb through the names, like, which good on the Palestinians for being like, well, find the Jewish names. And she's like, I can't, I'm German. It's like, exactly, you'd be perfect then.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, my father was a member of the Gestapo, like, perfect, you know, but as she's like picking up like the, you know, because it's like really hammering home, like, you know, this is bad. Because you get the one guy as he's handing the passport, you see he's got the little, you know, tattoo on his arm from, you know, a death camp. And so you can be like, Holocaust survivor.
And yeah, then he's gonna be, you know, basically he takes the hostage here because of it too. So
yeah,
it's really sad. Like I said, Golan certainly seems to have.
We probably need that today too, because there are like the increase of like people who think the Holocaust wasn't real. It's like,
sure,
you know, ridiculous at this point in time. So maybe we do need reminders of like that, you know, but still, like, in the context of the 80s, it is kind of like, you know.
True.
Hilarious a little bit.
Yeah, and I see what you mean about the TV movie sort of thing, like, that it's just really, like, outspoken for itself. And I think Golan has some things that he wants to say here, of course, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But, you know, it's a little overdone, and I could go without some of that. And it does take a lot of the film's time. And you're right, too. There's a long period of time where the Delta Force is just, like, fucking around on a plane. Like, reading Mad Magazine, you know, shooting the shit. And
Lee Marvin's eyebrows just growing longer and longer, you know.
Yep. And, too, this film is one of those movies that has a real problem with throwing up location data on the screen that you don't really need to know about, like, because it'll just say like especially the beginning of the movie where they're reporting on the hijacking, it's like the Pentagon, and it just says, it's just like the Pentagon, a picture of the outside of the Pentagon, and they're just saying like, yeah, we heard about this hijacking, and it was like, literally the next Washington DC is like,
didn't you Lee Marvin at the bar in Fort Bragg, and he's like, all right, sweetheart, what if I told you got nice legs? And she's like, oh, you can't see them. And he's drinking his Budweiser, and he's like, you're right. Hey, sweetheart. Say, sweetheart, come here.
Hand me that phone.
Give Colonel a kiss.
She's like, oh, you're terrible, Colonel. Yeah, no, It has a problem with like reporting locations that don't fucking matter. Like that's just like screen time. Not only that, but it gives you like fucking stupid timestamps too. It's like 3:45 in the morning. They're flying. Okay, no one cares. No, literally no one cares what time it is. Because there's no sense of time in this movie.
7:24 a.m. brunch at the McDonald's.
The one thing I really like too is like when they're reporting on it and literally fucking, so you, like as you said, Colonel's at the bar at like 2:30 in the morning watching on the news. Then you see they cut to Chuck Norris. He's fucking on the farm doing what? Making himself a sandwich at 2:30 in the morning. Why is this man up right now?
Can't sleep when America's at war.
Yeah, and that's the thing too. He sees that news broadcast and he's fucking skedaddling. He's like, you know what? This is the perfect job for me. I just love it because no one called on him to do it. And actually, because he resigned, he's on part of the Delta Force.
No, didn't you hear when he finally shows up? He's like, it's a good thing you showed up because if you did, I was going to serve you with this. It's the president saying you're back in duty.
He's another one of those guys that's just can't be beat. He's the ultimate. No one's better than Chuck Norris.
And he got a promotion as soon as he goes onto the thing.
I know. Yeah. Right.
Come with us, Major McCoy.
From resigning from duty to getting a promotion to major, it's a pretty, probably people in the troop are fucking pissed. Like other people are like, that was my promotion. Now after he resigned, I was expecting to be promoted to major any time now.
I just find it funny too that it's a bunch of fucking officers running around in this forest, like Cuddle, fucking Lee Marvin's running out there, old and geriatric, firing on machine guns and shit. It's like he's a colonel. He's not gonna be sneaking in with the privates and corporals and sergeants and lieutenants. He's gonna be far away, being like, "Hey, how's that going out there?" You know, safety with Captain Chuck getting Major Chuck. He's not gonna be running around out there.
And I mean, this movie, It was never published, but I'm gonna say it. It's probably the movie that caused Lee Marvin to die, 1987. This is his last film.
This is her last hurrah. He's like, his soul couldn't take it.
This was it. Yeah. Poor guy.
I do like, too, that he's basically Lee Marvin from the Dirty Dozen. Just gruff, you know, God damn it, God damn it.
Yep.
Damn it. God
damn it. Yeah, he is. I mean, I think he does a good job, though, in this movie, like, because I think he does have like a nice personality that you kind of gravitate towards in this movie. Whereas Chuck is kind of standoffish. You're supposed to like him, but he's also like the lone wolf type guy. And he doesn't really have much of a personality at all. He's just kind of like a veneer of a guy, really. All he's really motivated to do.
He's Clint Eastwood, a plink throw fucking roundhouse.
That's right. I mean, in this movie, he doesn't really do a lot of fisticuffs. It's mostly guns and a fucking missile launching motorcycle. The scene where he uses his motorcycle and has to catch the plane, though, it's pretty cool. Stupid, but it looks cool.
It's only cool because the music's playing.
Yeah. What do you think about that whole scene at the end where, you know, he's facing off against, literally, like I said, it's a whole convoy of terrorists in, like, jeeps and shit that they're in Lebanon now so he can attack, right? Because they're not in Beirut, they're in Lebanon. And he's, like, fucking waiting for them with his motorcycle with missiles strapped to it. And not only does it have missiles on the front, it's got missiles on the backside, too. So he can, like, look like he's farting out missiles. There's that one scene where he shoots it from the backside and it's like, you know? What do you think about the whole thing?
Well, our old director here was being like, I can produce a Bond film, see?
I know.
It is very James Bondy. Like, all it was missing was, like, you know, the nice score popping up, like,
Does the film ever specify where he gets this stuff from? Like, where is he getting this missile-mounted motorcycle?
The Israelis.
They just supply missiles.
I'm pretty sure why Israelis, because they're all carrying around the entire film Uzis, which...
If the Israelis have missile-mounted motorcycles, then why is there a Palestinian conflict? Fucking ended already, if you got that sort of tech.
Well, no, I think like all the stuff they use is like Israeli Defense Force.
Squad
is just running. They're all just running around with Uzis, which are Israeli. So it's like, and it's funny too. They're like shooting like from 5,000 yards away from their Uzis, hitting people with it. Like,
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right too, because Lee Marvin actually, or no, it's not Lee, but it's the other guy that's part of like the back at the Pentagon, who's like, I think he said, it's Robert Vaughn, I think. General Woodbridge, he says, you've got the Israeli arsenal, everything at your disposal. So yeah, I think they're using the Israeli all their equipment. So I did not realize that they had missile mounted motorcycles as part of their disposal. But
well, maybe that's why you say that it's a revenge porn. That's what he's wishing they had, so he could they could just drive right on through the West Bank and Gaza and just rocket attack them.
Wouldn't that be nice? Hilarious. I think it takes away a little bit. I would have rather had it be a little bit more realistic, because it just, if you want to think of the Delta Force as being this elite spec ops, like, the film doesn't really show you that too much, because they don't get a lot to do. They do storm that compound the one time, but for the most part, it's relying on like unrealistic shit that happens. And mostly Chuck Norris, who takes them on one-on-one, basically, because he knows that sometimes you have to disregard orders in order to get things done. So, what else? What else did you want to talk about? We did talk about Ingrid a little bit, especially when she's asked to pick out the Jews. But what do you think about Ingrid's character? Because the film really makes note of her later on when she gets off the plane and Lee Marvin's interviewing her. He's like, so what's going on that plane? And she's like, they brought out all these terrorists. And like, that's when Lee Marvin has to radio. He's like, abort the mission. because they're going to basically storm into the plane. It's pretty hilarious. But what do you think about Ingrid as a character in this movie?
It's just, she's funny. It's just so fucking ridiculous. I won't tell you where the Jews are. I can't tell you where the Jews are. And then she's like, that one there. That one there.
Yeah. I will tell you who the Jews are.
And then Father O'Malley comes up and says, I'm a follower of Christ.
Yeah. Who's
a Jew?
Yeah, George Kennedy in this movie is fucking Father O'Malley, who looking like a brick shit house in this movie too.
Yeah, see,
hours over the goddamn terrorists.
I also love too, they have poor Yakov Smirnoff's like, no, I'm Eastern Orthodox Russian, man. You know me from Chicago. Tell them. And they're all sitting there like,
yeah, not only that, but Kim Delaney's in this movie as that one sister. So they're like, Father, you'll be okay? It's like, I've got to do this. This is my
repentance.
Yeah. Now, speaking of George Kennedy too, at the end of the movie, when Peterson gets killed, they're basically like standing over his body on the plane, because he miraculously survives until they get back to the plane, where they can all have a hearty farewell, where he can shout out his one-liner again, whatever he says. He says, like, I'll see you when I see you. They've had him say like three times throughout the movie. I think he actually literally says it twice in a row when he radios Lee Marvin, and then he radios Chuck Norris, and he says to both of them, I'll see you when I see you. So the film is really like, yep, that's his catchphrase. All right, folks. You don't know this guy, but that's what he says. He's a character. At the end, he says that. And then, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, pops Father O'Malley. Fucking pops out of thin air to give the final prayers. And if it was me, I would have been like, who invited you in here for this deeply personal moment where Peterson dies. He wasn't even religious. He was, you know, he's fucking Hindu. So we don't want any Christian rites in here, okay?
It's not even Christian. It's Catholic. Yeah. Papists aren't Christians. Get it right.
It's just funny, though, because all of a sudden he pops out and is like, no wonder people don't fucking like Catholics who constantly, like, try to push their religion on other people.
You know what's great, too? They're gonna go back to Chicago and have a nice Chicago hot dog and deep dish at a Cubs game, drink some old style, and be like...
The one thing I like, too, is they fly the hostages back to Israel, and then they just leave them. They're like, all right, find your own way back home. All right, we're out of here. We're taking off.
What do you mean? What do you mean you don't want to stay in Tel Aviv?
Or what do you mean they took all your passports? Guess you're out of luck. Talk to the Israeli pastor. I don't know.
Especially at the police story too, where poor May got sent off to where the fuck she gets sent off to?
Bali.
Bali with no passport because Jackie Chan had it.
Yeah.
She's like, I got locked in a prison for 24 hours.
I know. They just kind of leave him there. Like, because it's a little confusing because actually Peterson, before he dies, he asks Chuck, he's like, are we going home? Chuck's like, yeah, we're going home. So you're like, oh, they're going back to the United States. No, they stop off at Israel and drop him off with all the other hostages and then just up and leave on their own jet. Gonna leave them there. What else? Anything else that you wanted to add that we didn't talk about?
The action. So, what do you think of the action overall?
It's you're pretty much your stereotypical 80s movie where it has like lots of bullets that fly and you see them hit, but you don't see any of the aftermath. You don't see any of the blood. It's just like people get hit and then fall off a building. You're like, oh, okay, they must have gotten shot. So,
unless they're evil, because the one guy picks up the bad cushion and the guy's laying there, he plugs him three times in the chest, and you get this, you know, the squibs, and he's like, sleep tight.
That's true. If you're really bad, then you definitely are getting a violent death. And I think Abdul gets that too. But for the most part,
I like how Chuck was playing Ring Around the Rosie with him in the fucking house on the motorcycle. That was great.
Yeah, I know. it's like your generic 80s movie, because a lot of them did that, you know, just squibs that don't really have any violence to them. You know, for all intents and purposes, for the most part, this movie could have been PG-13, honestly, especially now. It's not really out of the realm of being a, you know, PG-13 movie with like a Taken sort of thing, because it's not really that violent or anything. So, I mean, I think the action is all right. The explosions are pretty good. Some of the stunts are good. Like I said, Chuck Norris's stunt on the motorcycle, that's pretty good. But other than that, the film doesn't really have that many stunts, and it doesn't have that much action, to be honest with you. It's kind of mundane. What did you think?
No, it's pretty pedantic. Just doesn't really have any punch or zest to it. Like, none of the action's really creative either. It's just like, oh, shootouts and people jumping and getting shot and explosions. I wasn't really impressed. And for how interminably long and insufferable this film is at times, like, that's definitely a letdown that, you know, there's no big payoff.
Yeah, I mean, I think it takes like almost 90 minutes to really get a lot of the action going, which is a really long time for a movie like this. And 2 hours and 11 minutes, movie's too long already.
I had to take a break.
Yeah.
I had to take a break with like 40 minutes left because I was like, oh, you know, well, gotta be close to the end soon. It feels like I've been watching this all damn day. It's like 40 minutes are left. Come on.
Yeah, it definitely is a long movie, unnecessarily. It doesn't need to be that long. I think we, you could easily shave off probably 30 to 40 minutes of this movie. Because there's not, it's not like it's doing anything like that's compelling to the plot. It's just a lot of setup. And I think, again, you could cut out a lot of the hostage element to it at the beginning of the movie and still have the same impact, but without having to see like them literally name names, like calling out every single Jewish guy's name. It's almost like you're watching a graduation ceremony. You know? Because they literally have to, like, and then not only that, but they have to have tearful goodbyes and stuff. Like, we got it. We got it after the first two. You don't need to see all
seven. No, and each, you know, say, like, each husband, I mean, wife afterwards, like, you know, for 5 minutes, like, no, I won't let you. I won't let you. I won't. No. Oh, no. You know. Yes. It's tedious.
It is. Yeah, like I said, I would rather them have cut some of the movie out in order to have a more impactful, like, and truncated 90 to 100 minute movie. I think that's totally doable for this. So, just overall too long.
Sure thing, boss.
I thought they were really going to get in the "we don't negotiate with terrorists" line, but they didn't. There's that one.
No, Reagan did, because he's a bitch.
All right. So, on a scale of 0 to 10, random Hebrew rings that they set up.
Song of Songs.
Yeah, that they set up multiple times. So you can't be confused that this is going to happen. What would you give the Delta Force?
Give it 5.5 out of 10. Comparatively speaking to the other two Chuck films, I think Invasion USA is the only one so far that I've enjoyed watching. I didn't give that a great score either, because it is so fucking batshit stupid. But that's at least fun. This film is just like Missing in Action, where it's too damn long, it's too damn tedious. The premise is just jingoistic nonsense with tepid action. And that's its biggest sin. The fact that this film is 2 hours and 10 minutes long, and it's just this long-winded American, Israeli, jingoistic nonsense. It's just fucking stupid. And the film is, like I said, it plays like a TV film or like a mini-series. Maybe as a mini-series or, you know, TV film would be better. As an actual theatrical film, this is just too damn long, too damn boring. Which is sad, too, because I think Chuck doesn't get a lot to do, because he's absent for, like, the first half of it. But he is fun. He does have a good one-liner every now and then, and he is a presence. Lee Marvin? I love Lee Marvin in this. I think he's great. He's a lot of fun. And, you know, in a movie that he's too damn good for. But, I mean, overall, it's... like, everyone's fine, like, but, like, I think the fact that it's just so played out and so hammy and so over the top, it's just ridiculous. Like, especially nowadays, too, you know, with what's going on with, like, Palestine and Israel, you know, to be this jingoistic and about Israel's kind of, you know, it's not nonsensical. It's like, after this movie, they were inspired once again to storm into the West Bank and kill some more Palestinians in an act of revenge, you know? Woo! So, it's not good. And it's not that fun. And if you can't do what these films are supposed to be, fun. Commando's a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun with Commando. You can't fucking do that. Then you're a waste of time. So, 5.5. I would never probably ever sit down to watch this again. It's tedious beyond all belief.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would probably give this a 6 out of 10. I found it somewhat enjoyable, especially like the beginning parts of it with the hijacking. I thought that was kind of fun. It does go on too long, and I think that if it takes about 70 minutes for the Delta Force to actually kick in and do anything, then your movie's got something wrong with it. You know, you would want your namesake to actually have a bigger presence in the movie than what the Delta Force actually has in this movie. So I think that it kind of misses the mark a little bit with that. Needed more action, needed more to distinguish it from some of the other action movies at the time, because besides the missile mounted motorcycle, there's not much here that is really like interesting or different from what you've seen before, especially even from a Chuck Norris movie. Kind of interchangeable. So it's an all right movie. It can give some entertainment. It's definitely way too long, and that's probably going to hinder rewatchability. And then not only that, but you have to factor in like the TV movie element, that it feels really similar to a TV movie, and it has that score that's just omnipresent, that either you're going to like and you're going to find it kind of funny in a, you know, they've overused that sort of way, or you're not going to like it at all, and then it's just going to be way too much for the viewer. So I think that this movie definitely does not have a lot going for it. If you do enjoy 80s action movies, there might be some stuff here that is interesting, but overall, it's kind of a flop, another flop from Chuck Norris. You know, especially considering the intrigue and politics in this movie, it really doesn't have any subtlety to it. So, you know, there's not much in the way of themes here that you can really pull out of it. So I'd say 6 out of 10. All right, we have one episode left of Red Hot 80s Action Summer. And the last one that we're doing, what'd we decide?
We're doing Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior.
The Road Warrior. I'm excited for that. We talked about this on and off because we weren't sure if we were going to do it. We haven't done the original Mad Max, but that one is not an 80s movie, so it's kind of out. So The Road Warrior, I think is going to be okay, though, because we've already done Mad Max Fury Road, so it's not like we've gone in any order. So I'm excited for it. Should be fun.
If you need your guzzling, come to me.
That's right.
We should just do a George Miller month where we bounce between Mad Max 2.
Hey!
Beyond Thunderdome.
Happy Feet.
Yeah.
I do think George Miller's the reason why Robert Rodriguez's like output's like that.
Probably.
Grindhouse.
Shark Boy versus Lava Girl.
I know.
Spy El- Kids.
Machete.
I know. It's funny that he has that sort of output, but you know what? I like a well-rounded director, so. Should be fun. I'm excited for Mad Max 2. It's a good way to end part 3. And then we're moving on into our Halloween month, so we're going to...
God, by the time fucking Furiosa comes out, can you believe it? It's been almost a decade since Fury Road came out.
I know.
Makes you feel old as shit.
It does, because I remember seeing it. I still remember it pretty distinctly, seeing it in theaters, so.
Yeah.
No.
One of the best theater-going experiences of my life. All right. You can listen to that in our Fury Road episode.
That's right. You can.
All right, you know what's not fun that's Mad Max related?
What's that?
The PS4 game.
That's true.
It's Arkham Asylum, but just like Arkham Asylum, it gets incredibly tedious halfway through. So
that is true. Yeah, that is the Mad Max game, not as fun.
So sorry, go ahead.
No, that's fine. All right, so if you like our show, if you want to hear us cover more action movies for our Red Hot 80s Action Summer, you should subscribe to us on pretty much any podcast app you can think of. We are on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, our home base at anchor.fm, which is now Spotify. subscribe to us on there. Leave us a nice review. We also are on Facebook and Twitter and Threads. Just search for us on there, Blood and Black Rum Podcast. We have an email address at bloodandblackrumpodcast@gmail.com. You can write to us. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, what movies you want us to cover, and we'll take that into consideration. And you can donate to us on our Patreon page, patreon.com/bloodandblackrumpodcast. Anything you donate, we'll put back towards beer. So we appreciate that in advance. Check with us next week as we cover Mad Max 2. And like I said, after that, in September, we're going to be starting our Halloween movie marathon. So that'll be a lot of fun as well. So we hope you tune in again. We hope you enjoyed this episode as we cover poor Chuck Norris movie. And until then,
take care.